Blog Talk Radio.
Looking back when I was small, to memories when snowflakes fall, with mom and dad and I'm blessed for what they've given me.
I give to you,
and you give to me, true love, true love, so on and on,
it will always be true love. And I have a guardian angel
on high with nothing to do.
All righty, we are back for Season 5, Episode 11 of The Hollywood Connection. I'm the host of The Most Jimmy Falcon. Unfortunately, Jane Clark Smith is still doing, well, I guess not unfortunately. Unfortunately, she's not here, but she is doing some stuff with her family, I believe, with Thanksgiving and everything. So we do miss her, but I'm sure she's having a great time. Hope everybody had a great Thanksgiving. This is the first show I've done since Dark History Con, and it was great. A lot of great memories and got to see a lot of great friends. I should be putting up the interview with Ari Lehman. I'll probably do a show in a couple of days and play the interview with Ari Lehman. And it was really awesome talking with him, and it was great meeting Owner Ray and seeing Robert Lissardo again, and of course all my other con family. It's always a good time. Our guest today is actor Sandy Helberg. And Sandy's had a great career, born in Frankfurt, Germany, and grew up in Toledo, Ohio. He was an original member of the Groundlings and has been in some very awesome films, including Mortal Kombat, School for Scoundrels, Nate Wally Sparks, This is Spinal Tap, and Spaceballs. And I'm going to get ready to try him back here in a couple of minutes. Unfortunately, he didn't answer the first time, so I hope everything is all right there. And I will go try to get him back on the line. I'll get him on the line, and we're going to go play a little bit of Warrant. So we'll be back in just a couple of minutes on Full Relief Radio.
come on now. Give me what I need.
Alrighty, we are back. Unfortunately, I did not get a hold of Sandy. I'm trying to upload the Ari Lehman interview, and it's been going for like 30 seconds now, and it's still 0%, so I don't know. I don't quite know how great that's going to go. But I hope everybody is doing good. I actually don't have any shows scheduled upcoming. I'm going to try to get a few more going before the end of the year. And then, as always, I'll probably take a little bit of a break because doing this for 10 years, I've absolutely loved it. But I guess, like anything that you do for a long time and with rapid succession, I guess at least rapidness in the interviews, I get boring and straining. And unfortunately, sometimes you just got to take a break from it. Because I would I'd hate to stop doing it altogether, but, you know, I think a good vacation from anything is good. But unfortunately, this is not uploading one bit. Oh, my goodness. It's like a 15-minute interview, so I'm wondering if it's going to take, like, 20, 25 hours to upload this thingamabob here. Yeah. I'm going to go to, LA Times and see what's going on there. It's been a while since I've pulled up LA Times, and I try to get a little info off of there when I can, being that this is the Hollywood Connection. We do feel really bad that everybody's had the horrible fires when it was reeling after that. A lot of homes have been lost, a lot of land burned, a lot of lives gone and destroyed. Well, it looks like there's some issue about connecting rail lines. One of the most important elements of the $2 billion Crenshaw line, the light rail route under construction in Englewood and South LA, is a Y-shaped convergence of track at the end of the line in El Segundo. The junction could reduce the number of transfers required to reach a planned rail connection to L.A. International Airport that is slated to open in 2023. To accommodate the connection, the Green Line's operation will have to change once the Crenshaw Line opens in mid-2020, officials say. The two connection options and the service changes the passengers can face as a result have created a rare disagreement between the officials who represent the South Bay and the West Side on the Metropolitan Transportation Authority Board. Both options would allow riders to travel between Mid-City and Norwalk without changing trains, but one option would create a slower and more inconvenient trip for riders headed in and out of the South Bay, while the other would restrict the capacity of the brand-new Crenshaw Line. The difficulty, Metro said, is that the junction in El Segundo is designed to work more like an intersection than a freeway interchange. Two trains can't move to the crossing at the same time without risking collision, limiting the options of how trains can run through it, said Metro Senior Executive Officer Connor Chung. Metro's favored option would break the Green Line into two pieces. Aviation Boulevard riders along the portion of the line that runs along the 105 would be able to board a train every 6 minutes during peak periods, and ride west and north to the exit line without transfer. So I think this is actually, if they can get this going, it's going to be good. Hopefully we'll cut down on that on the travel, because those trains can get pretty packed. I've seen so myself. It's something very interesting. Barry Jenkins is also in the news. He says it's about time Hollywood pays attention to black novels. Dill Street is just the start. When Barry Jenkins decided in 2013 that he absolutely needed to adapt James Baldwin's novel of Dill Street to talk, the director made just one ultra-low-budget feature, and he certainly didn't have the book rights from Baldwin's estate. More to the point, Hollywood wasn't exactly searching out African-American literature despite the success as far back as 1985. The Color Purple, the Steven Spielberg-directed film novel, which earned 11 Academy Award nominations and more than $94 million at the box office. Before 2016, when Denzel Washington turned Finch's into a film with 4 Oscar nominations, including supporting actors winning for Viola Davis, just when August Wilson played The Piano Lesson, had been adapted by Hollywood as a Hallmark Hall of Fame TV movie. Author Zora Neale Hurston was adapted twice, in 2001 by Showtime from the 1933 short story The Gilded Pick Fits, and in 2005 for an ABC TV movie Their Eyes Were Watching God, starring Halle Berry. David Tony Morrison has been adapted just once, 1998 for Love, which is crazy, so Jenkins repeating himself for emphasis. This is crazy. Hollywood has always depended on source materials from novel stories and plays. The Godfather, Jaws, Jurassic Park, Lord of the Rings, and Harry Potter are obvious ones, but the list also includes The Birds, Amadeus, Brokeback Mountain, and countless other stories by white writers. Sure, there have been high-profile films with major stars or smaller projects that earned acclaim from African-American stories, including A Raisin in the Sun with Sidney Poitier and Lorraine. From Lorraine Hasbury's play A Soldier Story from Charlie Fuller's A Soldier Play, Spike Lee's Malcolm X from the autobiography of the Nation of Islam later, and Lee Daniels directed Precious based on the novel Push by Sapphire, with the lengthy subtitle added almost as an admonition. That was kind of a hard one. To remember the existence of black literature. Even after Terry McMillan's novels Waiting to Exhale and How Stella Got Her Groove Back found big screen success in the 90s, the next two adaptations of a work were struck on basic cable. And since 1995's Devil in a Blue Dress and in 1998, HBO adaptation of the novel Always Outnumbered, Always Outgunned. At least 8 Walter Mosley projects have been announced without ever reaching any screen in the last 20 years. So it's unfortunate. I think there needs to be more African-American works put to screen because, there's a lot of untouched potential there that really can have a great outlet for anybody who would be able to do it. There is lots of news on this LA Times. Holy cow. The Mexico and the Americans. This looks like an interesting article. Well, it's actually a whole lot of articles. Here we go. It's about the migrants. That's been a hot topic issue in the world for California. This thing is taking forever, school. Henry Diaz Reyes and about 1,500 other Central American migrants had just pushed past Guatemalan authorities and onto a border bridge to Mexico. Mexican federal police were waiting to go in riot gear. The official border entrance was closed. Police said the migrants shouted obscenities and hurled rocks at the police, who responded by launching tear gas. As the October 28th scuffle escalated, Geto started whizzing through the air. One struck Diaz, who fell to the ground, bleeding from his head. Rescuers rushed into the hospital, where the 26-year-old was declared dead. He had so many plans, said his half-sister, Glenda Reyes, who lived in Florida. Plans to work in the U.S. and have his son learn English. Plans to reunite with family members who had made the journey north and were finally living comfortable lives. They took them, Reyes said. Large-scale confrontations on Mexican's southern border were unheard of until last month. In the past, Mexican immigration agents regularly deported Central Americans in the country illegally, but usually after intercepting individuals or small groups well inside Mexico at checkpoints along highways or railroad tracks. That changed in the run-up to the U.S. midterm election, where President Trump began referring to migrant caravans as invasions and threatened to withhold aid from Mexico and Central American nations that failed to stop them. In response, Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto ordered hundreds of federal police to the southern border, putting them on a collision course with a group of migrants, mainly from Honduras, that were heading north to Guatemala. It is unclear what training or instructions the police on the border bridge had received. Dozens of migrants and 10 police officers were injured the day Diaz was killed. An autopsy performed by Guatemalan authorities found that Diaz died from a traumatic brain injury. Authorities have said police fired only tear gas. Found at the scene, however, were casings that law enforcement experts said appeared to be from powerful projectiles that are designed to penetrate doors or other barriers and release chemical irritants but not to be fired at people. The experts based their opinions, made independently, on two images of casing, one taken by a photographer working for the Times who was several feet from Diaz when he collapsed, the other captured by a journalist working for another outlet and uploaded to YouTube. Excuse me. So the migrant thing is definitely a big issue. I think it is kind of scary for most Americans to think of, this, like 1,600 people undocumented coming toward America. It is kind of interesting and even scary in sorts. See here. Here's an article about Toys R Us. Excuse me. Toys R Us and Bon-Ton may be gone, but they haven't been forgotten. Companies include Target Corp and online mattress firm Casper, recruiting playbooks to pick up market share that those and other defunct or dying retailers leave behind. Casper, for instance, is teaming up with department stores such as Nordstrom to introduce pop-up mattress shops in areas where a mattress firm, which filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy in October, had locations. And Kohl's has been mapping out where retailers like Bon-Ton and Sears Shutter Store took a target of those customers with specific ads. Kohl's is also adding more beauty products, which have been an area of expertise for Bon-Ton New York. The New York, Pennsylvania department store chain closed the last of its stores in August. Kohl's believes one-third of its store base is benefiting from department stores closing up from one quarter a year ago. Target Chief Executive Brian Cornell estimated up to $100 billion in market shares is up for grabs, about double what he foresaw just a year ago. In response, the company is accelerating its store models in areas where bankrupt retailers once had stores. Target has devoted extra space at 500 of its stores for bigger toys like electric cars, playhouses, and musical instruments, as well as adding nearly 200 more products. About half of those locations are about 5 miles from former Toys R Us stores. Regularly look at retailers on the Moody's credit watch list, Cornell told reporters last month, to think about strategy market by market. In 2018, roughly 30 retailers had filed for bankruptcy, including household names such as Sears Holding Corp, Mattress Firm, and David's Bridal. That compares with 441 last year, the highest since 2011, according to S&P Global Market Intelligence, a research firm both Toys R Us and Bon-Ton liquidated this month after trying to reorganize in bankruptcy court. Who doesn't have memories of going to Toys R Us? Man, I mean, from when I was like a little kid up until last year, I went to Toys R Us. And it says that the Ari Lynn interview is actually is processing, so I might actually just play the Ari Lynn interview. Yep, I think I will. And hopefully we can reconnect with Sandy Halberg. I'm gonna actually go play the interview I did with Ari Lehman this past, last week, 1 week ago today at the Garden Hotel in Urbana at Dark History and Horror Con. We'll play this 13-minute interview and we will wrap up. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
All righty, we are back with another live edition of Cloverleaf Radio. I'm
Cloverleaf Radio.
Jimmy Falcon, along with the first Jason, the original.
Jimmy Falcon, Jimmy Falcon, Jimmy Falcon is a great person, and you are listening to Cloverleaf Radio. This is Ari Lehman, the first Jason Voorhees from Friday the 13th. Jimmy, we're here at Dark History and Horror Con
right. In
Urbana, Illinois.
And it's going great. Are you enjoying yourself?
Oh, absolutely. No, what a great group of people. My good friend Ben, who does all the videos for my band First Jason, his buddy Brian is running the show. They said, come on down. So, we're here because it's family. But you know what? We're having a great time. Just an amazing array of horror, paranormal, all kinds of artwork and music and dance. It's amazing.
And, you know, going back to the first Friday the 13th.
Yes, 1980.
Did you have any idea that that would become such a major franchise?
Oh, no, Jimmy, absolutely not. As a matter of fact, it was ironic in the sense that I had done a comedy for Sean Cunningham. He was trying to distance himself from his work with Wes Craven,
right.
Last House on the Left. And so he wanted to go family, having just had a couple kids and living in Westport, Connecticut, and, you know. So he thought, which was a great idea, let's do a movie about soccer. But it was 1979 or 78.
Right.
78 when he did that movie.
Wow.
And long before the first Soccer Mom. But, you know, so long story short, I mean, the New York Cosmos were in that movie. Parts were filmed in Cosmos Stadium.
Really?
I mean, you know, famous soccer players. But anyway, long story short, he calls me the next summer. Oh, my God. We only have this much money and this much time. We have to shoot this horror movie.
Yeah.
I said, a horror movie? Wow, that's fantastic. He goes, yeah. So we want you to come down. Okay, you're going to be the monster. And
nice.
When you're 14 and you're told you're going to be a monster, you know, come on. You
that's
know.
Awesome.
So it was so much fun. And I got to work with the great Tom Savini, who basically, you know, took me under his wing to take the time it took to create the mask. And it was a lot of fun. Both Sean Cunningham and Tom worked very well with kids.
I don't think a lot of people may understand that if it wasn't for Tom Savini, there might not have actually been a Jason in the movies. Wasn't it him that kind of spoke up for that?
Yes. Well, by all means, Jim, the original thing was that the scene where Mama's going, he was my only son. His name was Jason. He wasn't a very good swimmer, right? That was the flashback scene.
Yeah.
And that was going to be Jason's only appearance in cinema.
Right.
But they saw Carrie, and that inspired them. Tom Savini. Now, to be frank, it was all of them who really kind of... It was an idea that came at the same time, because they had done some test screenings, and they wanted to get a better response. So they were looking for a new idea. And ultimately, it was Tom Savini who suggested the idea. Victor, who wrote the scenario, and of course, Sean, who directed it. But they called me back. I thought we were wrapped in August of 1979.
Right.
They called me back in October, and they said, you know, I had gone home thinking, wow, I play a boy who drowns, you know. You know, hey, wait a minute. So then they said, no, now you get your revenge. I said, I get my revenge, so, you know.
Right.
And so, you know, the rest is history. They created that wonderful jump scare. But a lot of that jump scare's power comes from the great soundtrack by Harry Manfredini, which lulls you into a sense of calm, you know, tricks you to think the movie's over.
Right.
And, you know, they even made it look like the credits are going to roll. There's a policeman. Everything.
Right.
The water.
You think it's over.
Oh, yeah. They used every device to trick everybody. It was almost unfair. But they did that also, like with the first kill with Annie. You know, that first kill scene, it was where you're looking at her, and she's looking up, and she goes, no. And they draw the knife across the neck, and you're waiting. They're going to take the camera away. They're going to take it, but they never do. So it's like there's so many little devices that were dependent on the knowledge of how audiences reacted to film. So it was a double whammy, if you will.
Right.
They were scaring you, you know, with the storyline, but they were also scaring you as a movie goer. Yeah.
And in 2004, you started First Jason. What kind of persuaded you to get into that? I mean, you'd done some stuff music-wise.
Oh, no. I was primarily a musician all along. At that point, I was working for Tuff Gong Records, for Interscope Records.
Oh, cool.
But as a world music artist, and reggae and world music was what I was doing. So then all of a sudden, someone sent me a letter that said, did you sign this photo? And I was like, why would I sign a photo? And he said, aren't you Ari Lehman, the first Jason Voorhees? I said, yes. He goes, I just paid $50 for this on eBay.
Oh, wow.
I said, what? So it was a forgery.
Oh,
so
wow.
So that led to a series of me getting involved. Long story short, I was invited to the Meadowlands to be a part of a Fangoria Chiller Theater event.
Oh, nice.
And that was amazing. So as a performer, you know, it opened my eye. I had my reggae album with me, and a lot of the horror fans were very nice. They're like, yeah, dude, you know, I don't usually listen to reggae, but this is pretty good, you know.
Right.
And everybody was nice about it. But then I was like, you know, why don't I just hit them where they live? But it honestly, it took time. You know, I wasn't going to approach it in a gimmicky way.
Right.
I wanted to really own it. And I had friends like Reagan Youth were my good friends. Dave from Reagan Youth, I used to hang out with them. I saw White Zombie
in
the day. Sure, I used to love the Bad Brains. So it's like I went to NYU. So I was there and I could go to CBGB's. I would go and check out those shows. And that time period was fascinating, but I was into the jazz thing.
Really?
I was the jazz kid.
I don't see that in you.
No, you don't now, but see, it's funny because Dave Insurgent, the lead singer of Reagan Youth, he used to come to my dorm with his girlfriend, and I would play jazz for them.
Wow.
And then I would go and hang out with them, and they would bring me to go to punk clubs, because, you know, it was just that kind of scene.
Right.
And, you know, there was even some kind of mixture there, too. There was harmonic music, which was like Ornette Coleman's band members mixing with the East Village jazz. Hardcore.
Oh, right.
So you had, like, almost kind of a punky jazz for a minute there.
Oh, wow.
And now, you know, Afro punk is big now.
This thing
where you have, you know, but that time period was an amazing ferment of creativity in Greenwich Village at the time. So I was indulged, but it was the open-heartedness, the open-mindedness of the horror community.
Right.
They gave me a lot of leeway. You know, they said, okay, Ari, you know, let's see what you come up with. And quite frankly, at first I approached it, I was doing Misfits covers, Danzig covers, and even Dead Kennedys, and, you know, and then it was the bass player from Macabre, which is a murder metal band from Chicago. I moved to Chicago with my wife, and I started, you know, checking out the scene there. Bands like Johnny Vomit, who, Fabian, who's the drummer in our band, Prince Fabian. He plays in Johnny Vomit now. Way back when, Johnny Vomit was one of the Chicago bands that really inspired me. The Ugly, all these different bands from Chicago that just, you know, so I started learning and absorbing and, you know, but it was this bass player from Macabre, because they had a hiatus, so he took 2 years off. He was in my band, and he was like, Ari, you don't need to play those covers. And he said, Ari, you need to bring the keyboard in. So I was like, how am I going to bring the keyboard in? How am I going to do this? And one day I saw a cosplay sword, this big cosplay sword. And I thought, holy shit, I just duct taped it. So, you know, that's how it all started. I put a guitar strap on the cosplay sword, and I duct taped my keyboard to make it into a guitar.
Nice.
So, you know, as time's passed, now Roland has made a guitar that I super love, the one I play. And then we had a team who does haunted attractions and special effects for movies. They're called the Brothers Rich. They made the current machete.
Oh, cool.
But now Roland has even made a guitar that looks like an axe.
Oh,
so
that's awesome.
You know, so times have changed in my favor. Right? I'm very fortunate. But most importantly, there's many scenes in the world where you would be alienated or ostracized as a newbie coming in, you know. But I've been given so much leeway. I mean, I'm talking about from the juggalos, from the punks, from the hardcore people, from death metal people. Everybody's given me the chance to do my thing.
Juggalos get a bad rap, it seems like. I've met a lot of great juggalos.
Oh, I agree. Oh, I love me some juggalos. Juggalos are the only people you call four o'clock in the morning and say, I'm fucked up on the side of the road. 20 minutes later, there's like five guys there going, you okay, Mr. Lehman?
Right. Helping you out.
Yeah.
Well, last question I always like to ask is what the future holds for you. I'm sure you got some shows coming up and stuff.
Yes, we sure do. We're doing so many great things. We're going to be playing all over the country, all over the world. But most importantly, we're now completing our fourth album, which I insist is absolutely going to be our best album. It's produced by Rob Rucci at Uptown Recording. He just did the two latest Nonpoint albums, the band Nonpoint,
which
is a Chicago new metal band. He is just an amazing producer. And so the new album is called Lord of the Lake. and it's got these songs. Voorhees is the name, Lord of the Lake, Rising to the Surface, Dark is the Deep, you know, Kill for Mother, you know.
Nice.
It's very much like, it's kind of got a, almost a deep purple, black Sabbath, very rock.
Very
so
cool.
It's just coming across the board, and the production is great, and I think we're about 4 or 5 days away from the completion of it, and here's the real exciting thing. I mean, the content is exciting, but the format is totally original. It's going to be on a USB flash drive.
Wow.
That's in a wristband that's shaped like a machete that I autographed. So it's a,
oh, that's cool.
It's an autographed machete slap wristband USB. But you're going to see this as the next few years come, because, you know, CDs are kind of a thing of the past.
Right.
But USB is everywhere. So now, it's like you take this USB on the wristband, you put it into your car, you put it in your phone, you put it in anywhere, it's going to play audio, video, it gives you a special priority pass to know what we're doing. So it's a new format, and I think that listeners out there should be very excited about this Your Flash format, and Lord of the Lake is going to be on that, and get a machete slap wristband, because this, it's a new day for musicians. In the sense that now we finally have something that's a mechanical that you can't download, that you, you know.
Right. No pirating.
So this way you can take the content, and I would love that, but you can't download my machete slap wristband with the autograph on it. And
right.
If you're gonna go, if you're gonna 3D print it, well, you know. But most people won't go to that lane.
Right. And if you know someone wants to book First Jason or book you for a convention appearance, how can they get a hold of you?
Oh, just go to firstjason13@gmail.com or just firstjasonofficial at Facebook. Come and talk to us. We're really happy. We're performing all over the country now, and you know, we work with local horror rock bands, and we make it an event that anybody who attends is going to remember for a lifetime.
Well, that's awesome, Ari. Thank you so much for giving me some time.
I appreciate it, man. Yes, yeah, so you got me in my best mood.
Alrighty, well, I was wondering, I kind of wondered if I recorded that last part. He's like, yeah, I'm in my best mood, I'm drunk. I thought that part was going to be on there, but thankfully it wasn't. Alrighty, guys, well, we will try to get Sandy Helberg rescheduled, and I want to thank Ari Lehman once again for doing that great interview with me last Saturday night. Hope you guys enjoyed it. Alrighty, we will be sure and check out my Facebook, facebook.com/theonlyhostwiththemost, or Clover Leaf Radio on Facebook for the next show. We will let you guys know. So thank you as always for listening. Have a great night.